You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 521. I think every woman should have a blowtorch. Julia Child.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Today's show is also sponsored by Vidafair. In a world where filmmakers are trying to find new ways to generate revenue with their films, Vidafair lets filmmakers set their own price for a 24-hour rental of their work, which includes features, docs, and perfect for short films. This is truly a revolutionary way for filmmakers to generate revenue with their content. For more information, head over to vidafair.com. Well, guys, today on the show, we have Oscar-nominated documentarians Julie Cohen and Betsy West. Now, they are the creative force behind the new documentary, Julia, which is about the legendary Julia Childs. And we discuss how they approach documentary, how they work the story, how they get the interviews, all the kind of creative story points of how they approach dealing with a legend. They had some experience with that because they also did the Oscar-nominated The Notorious R.B.G., which is, of course, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the late, great Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And we talk a little bit about how that project got off the ground and how they were able to put that whole thing together because she'd been very private most of her life. And we just get into the weeds of documentary in this episode. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Julie Cohen and Betsy West. I'd like to welcome to the show Julie Cohen and Betsy West. How are you guys doing?
We're great, Alex.
We're good.
We've just been having a lot of laughs before we started recording, so I do appreciate you guys coming on. I did have the chance to watch your amazing new doc, Julia, about Julia Childs, who I am a huge fan of, and I've loved your past work as well, which we're going to get into. But let's just jump in. How did you guys team up, and how did you get started in documentary?
Well, big question.
Big question. We teamed up through a project called The Makers Project, which was possibly not so surprising given some of the work that we've done subsequently about the history of the modern women's rights movement.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, that was like 10 or so years ago. And then, you know, we went our separate ways, more or less. And then in 2015, as Justice Ginsburg was kind of blowing up on the internet for the dissent she was writing, and I had both interviewed her prior to that. We came up with the idea of doing that documentary, and then subsequent to that, we've been working on a few films together.
Now, what was it about a documentary for each of you that made you want to go into this side of storytelling, this side of the industry?
You know, when I look back on it, I always loved documentaries. And, you know, I loved as a kid, I will now date myself, watching The World at War and, you know, just longer storytelling. But, you know, I became a broadcast network news producer and a behind the scenes producer working on shorter format and then magazine pieces. Julie and I have sort of a similar background, but I always loved documentaries back in the day, even when they were kind of, it was kind of the D word, you know, documentaries weren't so hot back then. But that's really what I wanted to do.
Yeah. I mean, similar deal for me, also came from the broadcast news world. Also just love documentaries. Like I like movies. So doing, telling real stories in the format of movies is really fun. Like my favorite art is always true story art. I love photography. I even love music that's kind of documentary-ish. You know, the Bruce Springsteen's like Ghost of Tom Joad album that's really sort of like a documentary in an album. Mm-hmm. Like anything that's real feels like kind of some of the coolest stories to tell.
Now, how do you guys choose the subject matter that you guys tackle? Because it doesn't take, 6 months, 3 months to make one of these things. It generally takes a few years. But how do you guys choose? And then how do you stay interested in it for so long?
Well, I mean, you put your finger on it, Alex. Really, you have to choose things that you want to spend 2 or 3 or 4 years on, or else, you know, you'll go nuts. And I think, you know, with Justice Ginsburg, it was kind of one of those light bulb ideas of, oh my goodness, what an amazing story, a current story, a backstory, a love story. I mean, you just couldn't have anything better than working on that. You know, after that film, we started looking around for other projects and thinking about other women who perhaps had not been appreciated so much and, you know, had really been groundbreakers, had really changed our world. And that's when we landed on the idea of doing Julia.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely not a formula that we have. It's the main decision point is like, do we want to delve into this? Because it is otherwise, like, you know, making a documentary, as your indie film audiences probably know, like it's a lot of work. It's a lot of time. A lot of the process is a big pain in the butt. So the reward side is feeling like you really love the subject matter. And we just realized like, oh, this one could really be fun. It's so different than other stories that we've worked on in our careers. And like, there's just like so much joy involved and kind of deliciousness. And it seems like subject matter that we really, really might kind of groove on.
You know, I think it also was a kind of filmic challenge for us to do something different. Yes, Julia has archive, but also the opportunity to do some high-end food photography, which mm-hmm. neither of us had really done before, and to really dig into that, we thought would be super fun.
Now, going back to RPG, what was it like working with her, interviewing her, being in the room with her? I mean, I have to ask, because she's essentially an icon at this point. She was an icon while she was a living icon when she was with us. What was that like? And how did you even approach that? When did you just call up, listen, Ruth, I would like to make this film about you. How did the whole process come to be?
You know, step by step, basically, we approached Justice Ginsburg pretty carefully and strategically. And initially, when we went to her with the idea of doing a documentary, she said, you know, not yet. I'm not ready. This was, you know, when she was in her early 80s. We're thinking, okay. But she didn't say no to us. So then we came back a couple of months later with the idea of, oh, well, we're just going to start to interview people, your friends and colleagues and whatever, you know, to kind of get her approval for that. And then we took it from there. So we didn't go in saying, oh yeah, we want to do a documentary and can we go with you to the gym, by the way? Like, we didn't start out with that ask, even though in our minds we were thinking it would be fun to go with her to the gym. But it was a slow building of trust.
It was a step by step. So when you were approaching a a subject like that, who is so high profile, you can't walk in with guns a blaring. You have to really kind of really baby step your way in to that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're always trying to ask questions to which you can get the answer yes. So those need to be small questions first. You don't come at some, you have to think of it from their perspective. Like, you don't come at someone with like a really, like, oh, we're going to impose on you so much. We're going to take up so much of your time. We're going to, you know, pick apart every aspect of your career. No, it's not like that. You're like, I mean, the way to get the process going is to try to start to get it going. So trying to come up with things that you think that your subject might agree to. And in this case, as Betsy says, it, you know, the initial thing wasn't even about us interviewing or even filming the justices herself. It was about like, oh, is it okay with you if we start to interview some of the people who you've worked with in earlier phases of your career, just so that the project, so that she starts to get the sense that this project is moving forward, and hear back from people that we interviewed like, oh, you know, these women were pretty serious about what they were doing, and they seemed like they'd done some research, and, you know, they seemed like they came in with this amazing, you know, woman cinematographer who had like greater, like this is like a real production happening here. So then you get that sense. And then at that stage, Justice Ginsburg let us start filming some of, you know, some public events that she was doing, and then later some more intimate or private events. And then the actual interview didn't happen until, you know, near the end of the process, actually 2 years into filming.
Now, I have to ask, I mean, how nervous were you to show it to her?
Well, you know, amazingly, Justice Ginsburg never asked to see the film ahead of the screening at Sundance, mm-hmm. and which we thought was a real act of trust, or maybe she was just too busy, or who knows, but she didn't ask. She agreed to go to the Sundance Film Festival, so we had both our major first premiere at Sundance there with Justice Ginsburg sitting across the aisle from us, and it was completely, totally nerve-wracking, and, you know, we were kind of watching her out of the side of our eyes the entire time as opposed to watching the film, and, you know, she started laughing right at the beginning because there is sort of a kind of funny opening sequence, mm-hmm. with statues saying mean things about her, and then, you know, just a little ways in, she pulled out a tissue and wiped her eye, and it was incredible. I can't even tell you what it was like to experience that and to have her like the film and appreciate it. I mean, it just meant everything to us.
And you guys, did you guys premiere at the Eccles at Sundance? Or was it at the Egyptian?
No. So, give us the other. I'm trying to remember, but it was
the Egyptian.
The
big one.
The Mark.
Oh, okay. I was just trying to visualize it.
About 500 people that have like a sort of bleachery, right? They're mm-hmm. sort of bleacher seats, and yeah.
That must have been, and then with the whole Oscar stuff going around, what was that like when you got that call?
Well, you know, you don't get a call. You watch it on television with everyone else.
Right.
The nominations being announced, and certainly it was fun.
Well, our husbands made us breakfast.
Right.
So we were at my house and we had a really nice breakfast. Then we sat there, and actually our name, the RBG name, was the last one in the list of the nominees. So we actually thought when they named the fourth one and it wasn't us, we thought, okay, that's it. You know, we didn't. So that accounted for our rather exuberant reaction. And it was more a reaction like, you're kidding.
Yeah, we were quite surprised. So that was fun.
So as the nominations were being announced, you're like, oh, just pass the hash browns. You're just like, it's over already.
Well, we weren't that casual. We had eaten already.
Okay, so good. I got you.
As he says, because we were the last one to be announced, yeah. Like, as the other films are being named, you sort of start to get the feeling that you're not going to mm-hmm. be among them. So
now,
it was exciting.
What was the biggest lesson you learned from working on RPG?
The biggest lesson from working on RPG. I mean, I guess, persistence, you know, slow and steady wins the game. I mean, that's what RBG did in her life. Lots of setbacks, lots of discouragement, you know, for a super smart person who gets out of law school and can't get the kind of job that she really deserved. And then, you know, just started finding this opportunity to challenge not only the discrimination that she faced, but the discrimination that all American women faced, and a world that people took for granted where women were second-class citizens. I mean, kind of an extraordinary thing that really came out of the obstacles in front of her. So I guess it's a lesson of persistence, and don't let anger get the best of you. Think strategically. Okay, you're up against a wall. How am I going to get past that? That was her approach.
Now, when you guys are laying out a film, how do you lay out the story? Do you discover the story along the way? Is there an outline? What is the actual documentary process as far as you guys are concerned?
Yeah, the process is sort of like continually organizing and outlining the story and changing that as you go along. Like, certainly at various stages, we have a rough idea of thoughts of what you want the structure of the film to be. Then at a certain point in the process, our editor gets involved. And in the case of both RBG and Julia, the same brilliant editor, Carla Gutierrez, was part of that process with us. So you very tentative outlines in mind, but often what works the best. I mean, we like to start, you know, in the same way that I was saying, you're trying to get to a yes pretty often. We try to start with some scenes that we really think are going to work, not worry about like the whole thing in one sitting, but just like, you know, take a bite of it, take a small slice of what the story might be. And like, once there's a really beautiful scene, then that gives you the optimism that you need to push to the next level and sort of piece things together. And if they're working, keep going in the direction that things are working. And if they're not working, make revisions to the parts that aren't working.
Yeah. I mean, we do use, the sort of modern method of the little post-its on a wall, which filmmakers know, where you write the scenes and the things that you expect you're going to have to cover, and you put them on a wall. Only we do it digitally now with this thing called Jamboard, which you can use to just move scenes around. And as Julie said, we start cutting scenes. I mean, in the case of Julia, one idea we had was, okay, people have seen this archive of Julia, you know, her cooking lessons have been repeated thousands of times, and, you know, people love watching them, but how fun to deconstruct the making of that show of the French chef from the very beginning. And we had the opportunity to do that because the producer, Russ Marash, is still around, and we found the stage manager, Alex Pyrie, and, you know, sat them down and had them take us through what it was like to put together this show, this groundbreaking show in 1963. And it was so fun, you know, to get the scenes of the kind of makeshift studio that they had and the photographs that Julia's husband took behind the scenes. I mean, I think people going to a documentary, they want to experience a world, you know, they want to be immersed in a world that they didn't necessarily know. They may know the characterization of Julia. They may cook some of Julia's food, but do they really understand Julia's world and what it took to become Julia Child? And that's what we're trying to get at.
Yeah, what I found so wonderful about the film was that, you know, my experience with Julia is obviously I've known her growing up. My mom had the book and everything. And I probably saw her on TV once or twice. But it was Julia and the Meryl Streep.
Julia,
which was a fantastic film. But that was the introduction to her story. And it kind of skims over a lot of stuff because it's, you know, it's a movie. But what you guys did was you went so deep into it, and I really didn't realize how groundbreaking she truly was. I mean, she changed how America cooked. It was and also was, you know, a women's rights icon as well. But before we keep going, how did Julia come? How did you decide on Julia and said, okay, we're going to spend 3 or 4 years with Julia? And how long did it take?
I mean, you could say it was 3 years from the time that we sort of first considered maybe doing it and the time the film came out. But like the first year of that is just trying to make the whole thing happen and trying to get someone who's going to fund it and trying to get the various entities, mainly the Julia Child Foundation, as well as WGBH, the Boston PBS station that had, you know, rights to so much of that archive. Like getting everyone on board kind of took a year, and then 2 years basically to make the film. And like the decision was, it's for the reasons that you said, because Julia was groundbreaking, and groundbreaking in ways that were going to let us in our film show the context of like, what was the crappy food that Americans were eating in the pre-Julia era? What was the vision of women on television that were being elevated before Julia came on the scene? Like, in order to understand how big a leap she made, you had to know what the world was before. And that gave us the opportunity in our film to like set those contexts. And we knew, because we know those worlds, like we know about bad food and we know about sexism. So we understood that we would be able to, that it would actually be pretty entertaining to lay that stuff out in a film form.
Yeah. And what I loved also is that you really focused on the love story, like her love story with her husband is just beautiful. And what he did was groundbreaking as well. A man of his generation to just push her into the spotlight, and he was happy in the background. It was like you said it in the documentaries, like that just doesn't, that didn't happen at that with those guys.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, we are attracted to story to subjects who have a good love story. And certainly the Paul and Julia story is fantastic because it starts out with Paul being the one who is opening up Julia to the world. You know, she had lived a rather privileged and sheltered life until she volunteered for World War II and met Paul in Ceylon, where they were both posted. And, you know, he was a worldly guy, 10 years older, knew about art, culture, knew about food, you know. So when they married and moved to France for his job with the State Department, that's when Julia just blossomed and discovered her passion for food and started cooking for Paul, which was really good for him. And we have, you know, a scene in the film kind of illustrating some of the benefits that Paul and Julia's love affair in France. And then, as you said, something unusual happened. Paul's career was in decline. He had left the State Department. He really didn't have anything to do. They'd moved back to the United States. And Julia, suddenly, her cookbook, after 12 years, is published, and she goes on television and becomes a kind of superstar. And Paul's reaction to that was just to help her every step of the way, to believe in her when she was writing the book that nobody else thought was a good idea, and to believe in her when she became a superstar, and to continue to help her for the next 3 decades. It's kind of extraordinary.
It's extremely extraordinary. And the other thing I found that watching the documentary is that she was absolutely fearless. Like, she threw herself into whatever, and she didn't care what anyone else said. How old was she when she started in this stage of her life? Wasn't she in her early 50s?
She was 50 years old when she first showed up on television. Like, Julia was not famous until she was 50, which truthfully is another part of the story that we really loved. And, you know, just like a good reminder for audiences, and particularly kind of young women in the audience, to see like, no, you actually don't have to have it all together and be ready to break out when you're 22. There are all kinds of different paths that people can take. And, you know, so that was, seemed pretty cool.
You mean you didn't have it all figured out at 22? I mean, I obviously, jeez.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something about the fact that Julia did have this later in life success that gave her the sort of confidence that she had,
right?
You know? And once she got there, she really she really was pretty strong in her beliefs about how to carry on in her life, in just in all aspects, and yet also someone who evolved and who changed. And we love that part of the story as well. It's not just like, oh, Julia went on television in the early 60s, it became famous and that was it. I mean, there were many more chapters and some challenges when she was kind of being pushed off the air by PBS, and how she met that challenge, and how she evolved in her thinking on social issues like homosexuality, which right. was, you know, pretty major in the 1980s. And she really changed her thinking and her prejudice, frankly, about homosexuals. So those parts, those aspects of the story of Julia's ongoing evolution, you know, really appealed to us.
The persistence that Julia had is absolutely remarkable, to be on a book for 12 years. I mean, many filmmakers listening and writers listening can really feel that. Because when I started, it's like, yeah, we were on the book for 12 years. To sit and to do anything for 12 years and to keep going no matter what, when there was no hope, there was no signpost anywhere that said this was a good idea. It's not like you're right. making a movie and they're like, well, other movies have been made before and made money or were successful. There was nothing like it. And she's just kept trying until finally someone opened the door for her. It was just so inspiring to see that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that Julia and the French colleagues that she was working with to develop that book really felt strongly that what they were doing was a good idea and would be valuable for home cooks. And that was the deep impetus. As you say, there was nobody saying this is a fantastic idea. They had gotten an extremely small advance, money that would have long run out by in the first year, let alone the 12th year. It wasn't like there was, you know, nobody was chomping at the bit waiting for this book. They were just like had this vision like, oh, this would be amazing. And I think they felt like they would get some real fulfillment out of putting down on paper, like, some of the amazing French techniques of cooking that, you know, that are well known in France and very much not known in the US. Like, they thought it would be a worthwhile thing to do. And that's where it started. Not so much. I mean, like, yes, of course, they wanted commercial success. As the 12 years go on, that is seeming less and less likely.
And
yet they keep going.
And I think that's a lesson that everyone listening needs to take on. It's like, if you believe in yourself, it's something that's just so believe, and the world hasn't caught up to that idea yet. It took the world 12 years to catch up to that idea, essentially. Yeah. And then it took a little bit longer for them to catch up with her being a 50-year-old TV star on PBS. I mean, it's just insane. It's like a PBS in Boston somewhere is like, she makes an omelet and then all of a sudden, like, hey, you want a show? Okay, we don't know how to do a show. Let's just do this. And it's like, if you would write it in a screenplay, you'd be like, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, you know, the part of that that I just love is that, you know, Julia just connected with the audience immediately. It wasn't like the executive said, oh, we've got a potential star here. Let's invest in this Julia Child person. Let's bring her along, you know? No. They said, okay, we'll do three shows. We'll pay you a minimal amount of money. And, you know, she was instantly just memorable. You know, people were like, who is that woman? What that crazy voice? But she's funny and she knows a lot. And we love watching her. So to me, it's this example of going direct to the audience you know, that's how it happened. It was not the TV execs who were doing it.
And what I loved also that you mentioned in the documentary was the SNL skit by Dan Aykroyd, which I always wondered. I'm like, I wonder if she actually got a kick out of that or not. And the answer is in the documentary. You were like, oh, okay. That she brought it out constantly bringing it out to show people. That must have been, I mean, she was an icon. She was even in the 75, was that 75?
Yeah, that was 75. And remember what, you know, what SNL in the 70s was, what a huge big deal it was. Just like, you know, one of our characters mentions that, like, in the early days of Julia's show in the mid 60s, everyone would be like, did you see Julia Child, you know, this week? Have you seen Julia's episode? Yeah. And of course, that's what SNL was by the mid 70s. Like, every Sunday, I mean, I was kid at that point, and every Sunday was just like breaking down what happened on SNL the night before. And I think that Julia understood that having Dan Aykroyd impersonate her was a real sign of, you know, cultural
stardom. Zeitgeist, yeah.
So she appreciated that, but like, you know, the problem, I mean, at the time, I think it's so fantastic. The problem is the decades have gone on that Betsy and I kind of came to discover that people who are familiar with Julia vaguely, like, that's what they remember. That.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
You know, a caricature of right. A completely zany, completely off the rails, like drunk lady, you know, with a chicken. And like, you right. know, Julia Child actually was a lot more than that. Not only was she a yeah. crab maker, but like a true expert in food and bringing that expertise to Americans, like in a way that mattered. So we are amused by that as Julia was, but we also wanted to, you know, the whole point of the film is kind of to tell you what the real story is behind that caricature.
Yeah, absolutely. And you did a fantastic job doing that. Now, did you learn what life lessons did you learn from Julia? I mean, because when you go into a subject matter like this, like with RPG, you have to, something has to rub off on you. So what was that thing?
I'll tell you one. You know, I like to cook, but often weeks go by before I really do cook. And sometimes my ambition gets the better of me. Like, I think I can create some great thing. And it's like, it's 10 of 7 and the guests are coming soon. And I'm like doing 4 different dishes. And often I'll be disappointed with how one or the other came out. And I, in the past, would apologize. Oh, you know, like this corn thing, it was supposed to rise more or whatever. I am never, ever apologizing again for a dish that I serve to people. I mean, and I love that attitude. Julia's whole point was, oh, you make a mistake, you make the best of it, you turn the potato souffle into something else and you just serve it. You know, you turn the dessert that flopped into a soup and you serve it and you do not apologize. So that's my life lesson. And I, once the pandemic and the shutdown is over and I actually am entertaining regularly again, I plan to implement that advice.
And again, a before her time feminist message, because like apologizing for oneself right. is a big lady problem. Like it just, yeah. you know, you do have an inclination when you're presenting what you've done to a room full of people to start pre-telling them like everything that's wrong with what you did. Like, oh, this was actually supposed to be bad. I used baking flour when I was supposed to use cooking flour.
It fell on the floor.
And it's like, just serve the food. Like, and Julia was like, you know, we all make mistakes. It's okay to make mistakes. But that said, don't like apologize for them. Just like, you know, say that's what you know. Say you meant this to be that kind of dish. It's fine. Like everyone, like if you give it a little hype, like the boys often do, that's gonna change people's perception of it and of you. And it's a great Julia lesson.
Yeah, as you know, I mean, I was raised surrounded by women. So I have no brothers or sisters, but I was just women, very strong women around me at all times. And now with my family, my daughters and my wife, I have no testosterone at all in my life. just the cat, and the cat got fixed. So so I feel that. And as a young man, you never ever taught to apologize for anything. You just go with it. You roll with it. And as I'm teaching my girls that, I'm like, no, I'm teaching them to be strong women and to teach them from a male side point of view and also from a female side point of view with my wife of like, no, this is the world and this is what you're going to be walking into. And my God, I can't even imagine walking into the world that she walked into or she lived in. You know, it's such a different world.
Yeah, and then imagine the world in France. I mean, we love that part of the film in France to kind of create what kitchens were like there. Yeah. I mean, talk about a macho, sexist environment that Julia Child walked into, you know, going to the Cordon Bleu with the master chef and the students were all male GIs from the U.S. who were using the GI Bill to further their education before they went back to cook in restaurants in the United States. And Julia's the only woman. We love that. And she seemed to have a kind of confidence about her, which I think was, you know, just part of her makeup, you know, that she didn't mind being 6 foot two.
Right.
Some women really don't like being so tall. It didn't seem to bother her. She married a man who was shorter than she was. I mean, she didn't have that self-consciousness. And I think also in breaking into a male world that she found herself in France, she was just very matter of fact about it. I want to learn how to cook. This is the best place to do it. And please, you know, let me into this class and, of course, impress them all.
And again, that fearlessness in what she said, because she towered over most men.
Yeah,
I mean, easily. I think that's also probably a little bit of where the confidence came from, because she'd always towered over men. So in many ways, I mean, this is just me, my psychoanalysis of it. But, you know, she does feel that kind of vibe. And you see these pictures of her in the documentary where these guys are just so small. She's just towering over. And it's just the confidence to do whatever she wants.
Yeah.
It's pretty.
And the interesting thing is, even though all of the ways that, you know, we're kind of socialized as women sometimes to be a little apologetic or a little demure or not show yourself, you know, off into the world, and Julia's self-confidence and the feeling and the being herselfness is exactly what the audiences responded to. They completely got that this was an authentic person. They saw that they're seeing the real Julia. They liked that she was fearless. They liked that she wasn't apologizing. They liked that she was loud, even. Like, everything that was real about Julia, which is a lot of things that girls actually aren't taught to be, even still, is actually what the public really responded to, and not just women. Like, guys liked her too.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I love the word you use, authentic, because that's exactly what she was. RBG was, is that they were who they were, and they were comfortable in their own skin and weren't trying to impress. They weren't trying to be something they are not. They weren't putting an Instagram filter on themselves in many ways. And that's what people are drawn to. I mean, in all of your work, even doing news and other things throughout your career, have you noticed the same thing I have, is that the people who get the attention, not all the times, but they are who they are, and they're not trying to be something they're not, generally speaking, especially the important people, meaning that people who are changing the world, people who are being of service to the world, like RBG, like Julia, because you can't fake Julia. Like, that's a hell of a performance if she's pulled that off for so many years. That's who she was. Do you find that that's one of those common factors in all the work that you've done over the years?
Interesting question. I'm not sure that I would want to make that generalization across the board.
No, it's case by case, right?
I think it's somewhat case by case. I mean, look, people are very different. There's such a huge variety of people. And sometimes, you know, what was so-and-so like? Oh, they're exactly like what they are, you know, what you would imagine on television. And, you know, you can say that, but that's not always the case.
Right.
There are certainly people who have a pretty good public. And I think that's, you know, sometimes there are sort of introverted people who then get in front of a camera and they kind of transform into something else. And I'm not saying I'm going to call that phony. I'm just saying that's the way they are. And then they get off camera and, okay, that's it. You know, they're moving on to something else. I mean, that was not the case with Julia. I mean, Julia was an extremely outgoing people person, loved being on television and loved meeting people in the grocery store. It didn't really matter to her. So I would say it's true of her. And it's, I think Justice Ginsburg, a very different character of, you know, really was an introvert who later in life had this amazing celebrity, but she was pretty true to her personality, I think, throughout, and was very much the same, you know, off and on camera, I think, in a way. But I wouldn't want to generalize it to everybody. Do you agree, Julie?
Yeah. Well, it was when Alex brought in our broadcast news careers that we were both like,
yeah.
speak to some people that were, I mean, you know, look, there are people that have gotten called out in recent years for not being the same nice guy on television that they, in real life, that they might have appeared to be on your morning television show. So, I'm just saying.
There is that. Yes, there was this. Yes, Julie had a nice smile on her face as you were talking. She's like, okay, I got. Yep, it's in my head. I know who it is. Now, I have to ask you, what do you think Julia would do with today's technology of social media, of all of that stuff? Do you think she would have? Would she have an Instagram account even in the later years of her life? Would she be out there really kind of connecting with her audience in that way? In your opinion?
Well, there's an interesting mixed thing. Like, of my husband actually always likes to talk about. There's some hypothetical about, like, what if Napoleon had had a B-52? And like,
well, of course,
so this is sort of similar. What if Julia had had? I think even might be an SNL skit. But what if Julia had had Instagram? There's sort of a two part answer. One is that the whole love of food on Instagram is really the world that Julia created, that like food is this amazing thing that so much, it's not just what we get to nourish ourselves, but you know, it's like to be celebrated and shown off. And like, so that's like really a validation of who Julia was. On the other hand, Julia had a rule. We mentioned it in the film. She called it French rules, which is when your food is served and still hot, you eat it immediately. You do not stop what you're doing to take the most glamorous overhead picture of it. Food is meant to be eaten, not photographed. So
she on both sides of that. Now, did you guys find yourself eating more while you made this thing? Because I found myself wanting to eat more as those beautiful food footage that you guys were shooting that I knew were in archival, because I was looking, I'm like, oh, that's fresh. Did you find yourself did you find a new respect for food? Did you find a new just, you know, all of that while making this?
Yeah, I mean, we have to say that we filmed most of it before the shutdown. We filmed a lot of it in 2019, including an amazing trip to France that was really so much fun to visit Julia's haunts and to eat some great food. But, you know, I think when the shutdown happened, all of us changed our relationship to food and to cooking. And, you know, I found myself going to the farmer's market, you know, shopping outside and thinking more about fresh food. And definitely, you know, both my husband and I were just cooking for each other every single night. And one night we made like a list of all of our regular dishes that we liked, you know, that were in our rotation. And there were like about, I don't know, 45 of them that were in our now in our rotation. And I think so we really expanded our possibilities. And I guess that was partly about the pandemic. And I think partly because all day long, you know, I was being immersed in this world of food. In the middle of the pandemic, we managed to do the high end cinematography that you see throughout the film, which was last summer. That we filmed under somewhat difficult circumstances with everybody masked or whatever, and created a studio down in Chelsea and replicated Julia's kitchen. Our producer, Holly Siegel, did an incredible job basically having a shop construct Julia's kitchen and sourced all the copper pots and the Garland stove and everything else, and then filmed for about a week with our cinematographer, Claudia Raschke. And then similarly in France, we were filming with a photographer using macro technology, really tight shooting and slow-mo of the food. That was Nanda Bradelard in Paris. We'd intended for the two of them to be together but because of the pandemic, that was not possible. So we did the Paris shoot remotely. So there was a lot of thinking about food, and I guess it did influence us.
Yeah, and we brought in a food stylist and cook, Susan Spungen, who not only prepared all the film and actually prepared all the food, and you actually see her in the film sometimes because it's kind of her hands that are rolling out the dough and that sort of thing, but helped us in the substantive quest of figuring out which Julia Child recipes would work well with which scenes. Like one example is we wanted to show something kind of messing up during the phase that they're experimenting with all different recipes. And we talked to Susan about like, oh, what could we show that would like screw up all the time? She came up with hollandaise sauce and how it breaks and looks all curdly and disgusting. And then, you know, if we're looking for the sort of love in the afternoon sensual scene, we asked her and we had a number of discussions, you know, what is the, so what dessert is like the sexiest? Like, what do you think? And we went in thinking it was going to be chocolate, because when you think desserts, like chocolate is the first in your mind. But then she described to us that pear tart and every step involved of the rolling the dough and the poaching the pears in red wine and or that custardy thing.
Beautiful.
Like, now I'm going to have to go and eat. But so when you talk about like where we implement, you know, just the enthusiasm for even certain food groups definitely grew during the production of this film.
Yeah, that tart, when I was watching it, it's a fairly sensual tart. I had no idea tart could be sensual. I was watching, I was like, wow, I want to have a slice of that right now. Now, where can people watch the film? And when is it be released?
People can see Julia in theaters in New York and Los Angeles starting November 12th. And then it will be rolled out in many, many theaters in cities around the country in the subsequent weeks. So by Thanksgiving, it should be available. If you want to see it before your Thanksgiving meal, you might want to have a snack just beforehand so you're not too hungry during it or whatever. I think it's a good, it's potential good Thanksgiving fare.
Now, and what advice would you give a filmmaker who wants to get into the documentary game?
Whoa.
It's a hard question. I mean, I think, you know, there's, on the one hand, technology is such that people could be experimenting with making short films on their own. That probably doesn't mean that that's something that's going to be headed for distribution. The other thing is to just, you know, there are a lot of documentary production companies all around, and getting in on the ground floor in the interning and production assistant mode is kind of always the way to start. But like learning some technical skills is kind of important. Some shooting and editing skills is great these days, as well as sort of some substantive knowledge. We always try to tell people it's actually good to know, like when people ask, like, oh, should I major in film or communications in my undergraduate college? Like, maybe, but also it's actually good to learn some things about the world and to understand something about business or science or politics or history, like, you know, especially for documentaries, like, you need to have some grounding in the real world before you're maybe going out and trying to say something about the world, which at its heart is what making a documentary is all about.
Now, I'm going to ask you a couple questions to ask all of my guests. What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
Thank you so much, Alex.
I'll start because it's a diffy view. I think of one while you Oh, you got one?
Yeah, I have one, but you go ahead. You go first.
Okay. I was just going to say to not worry too, I mean, in some ways it fits in with the messages we were saying earlier, to not worry too much about things that go wrong. Like when something goes a little wrong, that's all right. Things have gone wrong in every film that we've made, and it comes around. Like the biggest problem is what happens after the thing goes wrong, where everyone is so panicked about the thing that went wrong and trying to convince themselves and the others that it is not their fault, that then a cascade of things begin to go wrong from there. So like things go wrong, forgive yourself and move on.
Yeah. I mean, I took to heart RBG's advice, which she got from her mother, basically that don't waste your time on anger, you know, try to move past it. And yes, it doesn't mean you're not going to be angry. Of course, you're going to get angry. You're a human being. But try not to get consumed by anger and just find the way around it, because it's a waste of your energy.
Now, in any of your projects, there must have been a day that the whole world came crashing down around you. What was that event, and how did you get past it? And what did you use to get past it?
Well, I would say my whole world came crashing down around me when I lost a job in a very high profile way in 2005 when I was at CBS News. And, you know, it was kind of a wake up for me, and but opened up doors to a whole new life, because I had been an executive, and, you know, executive jobs are risky. You know, you're always... You're always the person, you know, that gets blamed when something goes wrong underneath you. And, you know, that's sort of what happened to me. But in general, I think executive jobs are tough. And I realized that I so loved making stories, telling stories. Right. That's what I really love, more than I loved being an executive, although, you know, I think I was okay at it. But I really loved doing that. And so that allowed me to pivot back to what I love doing the most.
And Julie?
Yeah.
Julie's never crashed. She's never crashed.
Well, the crashing experience, to me, the thing that I associate most with that is like when, you know, something that you thought was going to happen, like, doesn't happen. And that actually happens a lot in a world, like, where you thought you had a shoot and then you didn't and the person cancels, or you thought you had a booking and someone was going to cooperate with something and they didn't. And sort of similar to what Betsy was saying, like, in the end, I almost think almost everything that happens, there's a way in the end to think like, oh, it was good that did. It was great that we didn't actually get that person, because it wouldn't have led to the next thing that was so amazing.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And last,
you gotta have perspective.
And last question, three documentaries that all documentarians should watch.
Oh my God. All right. Hoop Dreams.
Yes.
To my mind. And I saw the remastering of Hoop Dreams thinking, oh my God, this thing is so long. You know, I think it's like 3 hours or something. And I was thinking maybe it's too long. It's just masterful. It's unbelievable. I love that film. And was so lucky to see it again recently. All right, that's one.
Documentaries to see. I think I'm going to say Waltz with Bashir. I really recommend that to everyone. It's an animated doc that came out probably around 2008, something like that. That's like just telling a story in a really new way, but that feels really emotionally profound. So that's one that I think of.
And one more. Any of you. I won't put you on the spot for three each.
Okay. There's so many.
Like,
what am I?
Like, for me, it was like Searching for Sugar Man, which was...
That was great.
That was a great one. And then Walking the Line, or the one with the about the tightrope guy between the Twin Towers?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
Hardwire. We both loved Raoul Peck's I Am Not Your Negro.
I Am Not Your Negro.
Oh.
Really different take on an archival film. It's like an essay. It's an archival film. It tells you something about American history.
Okay.
You know, I really like Stories We Tell, you know, that Sarah Polley film, which I thought was just really pushing the boundaries of storytelling in a way that works. Like, sometimes I think the boundaries get pushed in a way that confused me. But I thought that was, wow, what an interesting way to tell a first person film. I don't know. I like that a lot.
Betsy and Julie.
But
thank you guys again so much for being on the show. I truly appreciate it. And I hope everybody goes out and sees Julia. And if you haven't seen RBG, you have to go see RBG as well. So thank you guys for doing what you're doing. And please continue making amazing documentaries. So thank you.
We will.
Thank you.
I want to thank Julie and Betsy for coming on the show and dropping their knowledge bombs on the tribe today. Thank you so much. And if you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to watch their new film, Julia, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/5.
5-2-1. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It truly helps us out a lot. Thank you again for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.